G'day, this is Tommy Wren of Seriously Risky Business, and I'm here with the Gruck.
G'day.
First of all, I'd like to thank the Cyber Initiative of the Hewlett Foundation for their support, and also founding corporate sponsor Proofpoint. So today we thought we'd look at a paper that came out over the last week, which is actually a committee of inquiry to investigate the use of Pegasus and equivalent surveillance software. So this is a European Parliament report that looks into the use of spyware all across the EU. And as far as the actual collection of information, it's pretty good. It surveys the landscape. I've mentioned it briefly in the newsletter. Catalan talked about it, and it has some interesting stuff in there. Some countries are using spyware, what I would call responsibly. They're using it for what I would call lawful purposes that kind of make sense in a well-functioning democracy. Other countries are using it to gather intelligence on their own people, like the opposition party. So it's a real mixed bag. However, the Gruck sent me just this excerpt, which you really took offense to. and it's relating to zero-day vulnerabilities. It's got four sub-recommendations. And this is what the report recommends. So the first one's fine. Sub-recommendation A, information researchers should be able to research vulnerabilities and share their results. And it talks about having civil and criminal liability provisions that support that activity. So that's good. Second one, B, a ban on the commercial trade in vulnerabilities. And
okay.
Then you've got to disclose to the vendor.
Ooh.
So what's the problem here?
Okay. So I've been on record as saying that this demonstrates a lack of understanding of the history of vulnerability disclosure. And just to sort of briefly go over that. So historically what used to happen was you'd find a vulnerability, you'd give it to a vendor, and they would do nothing. They basically sit on it. You know, thank you very much, but if we say that there's a problem, people won't buy our software. So
yep.
There is no problem. So then sort of full disclosure came out, and it was, okay, well, I'm just going to do it publicly, and now you have to fix it, or, you know, not only will people know there's a problem, but they'll know that you don't care and that you're not going to fix it. So full disclosure was just dumping everything out there. So you'd be like, here's the bug, here's an exploit to prove that it works, and, you know, the vendor and you both get the same amount of notification.
Right, yeah. So that's the equivalent of just posting it to Twitter, I guess.
Right. That was the dropping O-Day phase. And
yep.
You can imagine that vendors were not thrilled with that. So it was basically, that was the full disclosure was used as a sort of stick to force vendors to actually do something. So then there was responsible disclosure was sort of invented as this idea of like, look, you give it to the vendor, they'd have a limited amount of time or, you know, a reasonable amount of time to patch it. And then you would both disclose it publicly and everyone would know about it. And so you would get your recognition for having been a smart person who found a bug. They would get better software and everyone's happy. Except that, you know, once it went to this thing where you like give it to the vendors, they went back to sitting on things as long as they could, minimizing. Sometimes they would do things like they would silently patch and release, and then the discoverer would not be able to say, you know, I did a smart thing. So
right.
That was always fairly contentious. Then the sort of, like, I'm glossing over a lot, but there's the No More Free Bugs movement, which was the realization that having your name in 11-point Arial font in the bottom of a press release was not necessarily the great reward for, you know, months of hard work that it might seem. So doing unpaid labor for billion-dollar companies, it's not necessarily a great thing. So there's a sort of pushback of like, we should be compensated for the work that we do. There's also a move to no longer calling it responsible, but calling it coordinated disclosure to encapsulate the idea that both sides are putting their information to the public at the same time, after the vendor has had an opportunity to fix it. So once the fix is ready, everyone knows at once. That's the idea. Project Zero at Google one of the things that they sort of brought to the table was that they put this hard 90-day deadline. We will give it to you and you have exactly 90 days. You know, I think it was plus seven, so that it wouldn't end on like a Sunday or a Friday night or, you know, just a little bit of wiggle room. And then they would release whether you were ready or not. And that helped. I think they did one study to look at the patch times over the course of their many years, and they have gone down. Mm-hmm. Microsoft doesn't meet them a lot. Microsoft is they're big on coordinated disclosure, not so big on 90-day deadlines.
Right.
Understandably, some of their stuff is quite complex, but you know.
Yeah, so I remember like Spectre and Meltdown. They were mm-hmm. way more than 90 days, but that was mm-hmm. like, you know, fine because it was complicated.
Right. Then we're sort of where we are today, where there's a mix of you could sell to certain commercial entities such as Erodium. There are bug bounties to sort of encourage you to find and report bugs. And the idea is that if you have more people finding and reporting bugs, you're not going to get the guys selling bugs switching over to bug bounties, but you're going to get more people doing bug bounties, sort of nipping at the heels of the guys selling bugs and therefore reducing the value in what they do, because there's this mob after them finding the same stuff. Sort of, that's the theory. They're not in competition.
Yeah, right. So this seems to be aimed at organizations like Zerodium that take vulnerabilities and mm-hmm. sell them on. So what's the actual problem in stopping just that part? So it's actually a commercial trade. I suppose this would leave bug bounties open, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this would be European legislation, I guess, is the other thing to mention.
Right. Yeah. And it's sort of aimed internally at Europe. It's, from what I understand, the intention is not to create a... they're not trying to change the state of the world by saying, like, we'll go first and then everyone can follow us because we've established like a great vision. And it's not necessarily like, if we do this, then we will kill the market for everyone else because we are such a big market leader that by us going out of it, you know, the rest of the world will crumble because the main market or the main seller, or whatever, you know, Europe is none of that. They're not really a big player in that. So the idea that they have is that if you require a bug bounty, then people will do that instead of selling to Zerodium. And that's just like that is not true, because those are different, generally speaking, those are different categories of people.
Right.
The sort of people that do bug bounties are one type of InfoSec professional. And the people who would do professional zero-day sale, that's what they're just going to do. Like, that's the thing that they're interested in. That's the money they like.
Right.
It's a different...
Yeah, yeah. So your argument is it'll make no difference because the people who are doing it will do it regardless? Is that the...
Sort of. You're trying to stop the people who are the least tied down to a geographic location, right? So because this is European only, and you're telling someone who is, you know, making possibly seven figures a year that you can no longer make seven figures a year inside Europe doing a thing that you can do anywhere in the world. So I suspect that some people might decide that they can do that, I don't know, Dubai or...
I'm not even sure how you would enforce it, though. Like, how would you know that a citizen is selling...
If they're getting paid in cryptocurrency as well, it's a bit difficult, but you could... I mean, let's assume that somehow enforcement is a thing that they can do, that they can look and say, you haven't declared that you are employed, although a lot of these people have companies that they work for that do this. And so things show up on, you know, they will show up on a company invoice as software development or security consultation.
Yeah. You know. Security services.
Yeah. It's not O-Day sale to mercenary spyware vendor for use against dissidents and reporters. You know, like, that's not a line item in an invoice you're going to see anywhere. So I think it'll be hard to stop in terms of if it's illegal, they won't do it. I think this is a prohibition sort of thing. Like it's, you're not going to stop the people that want to do it, particularly because they are free to move outside of Europe. Like they could move to pretty much anywhere and keep doing it.
Yep. So just to summarize, it's it won't affect the people it's aimed at affecting. I wonder if does it make Europe worse off if the that kind of means that the companies that do that business, that trade vulnerabilities, will not be in Europe.
And they will take the people who want to do that outside of Europe as well. So that's a particular high-end set of skills. And the thing is, I think that people don't do this as a forever career. You know, some do, but a lot of people will sort of, they'll do pen testing for a while, they'll sell some bugs for a while, then they'll go to do consulting, doing something else. You know, you move through your career into different things. It's not like, I don't know, it's not like becoming a torturer and then you find out that you've got like no other skills that you can use. My God, that's a terrible example. It's not like that. You're a highly skilled security professional and you do this for a while or you do something else. And so it could drive away, and by could, I mean, I really think it will. It could drive away a number of very skilled security professionals, the companies that they work for, and that's bad for Europe cybersecurity overall.
Yeah. So I wonder if instead of banning the commercial trade and vulnerabilities, if you want to stop this business, you just buy them all. Like be kind of a bit more direct about it rather than trying to ban it. So, okay, let's move on to C. State authorities should not purchase, keep open, or stockpile any vulnerabilities. This is so stupid.
Yeah, you had some thoughts on this one.
Well, it just annoys me because I don't think those organizations stockpile vulnerabilities. You either use them or you lose them, I suppose, is the phrase I'd use.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just so stupid.
Yeah, so I think a good way to think about it is that 0 days are a little bit like fruit, right? Like you get them, they're ripe for a while, and then they, you know, become unedible. Like they have a short lifespan, and that could vary depending on all sorts of things. But no one talks about stockpiling fruit, right? You don't like go out and buy a load of fruit for a rainy day and just sort of keep it until you need it. That's just not how, right?
Like the strategic fruit supply.
Yeah, strategic fruit reserve. Yep. Yeah, but like the other thing is these people are not, when they have a need, they will get a thing and they will use that thing. And if they anticipate having a need, same way. But they're not going to like go out and get five things and then use one of them and just have four just in case, right? Like that, they have limited budget and they need to, I mean, it's dumb in so many ways. Like, why would you acquire, you know, five Android vulnerabilities at the price of five times one Android vulnerability when you only need one? And you could use that additional budget to purchase other things that you can use instead.
Let's take Android because you mentioned it. And, you know, you have a particular purpose where you need to get onto Android phones. And you happen to find three different ways to do it. Would you keep all three?
I would probably not report them because my fear would be that the three that I find are similar in some way because I found three. Like I didn't find one memory corruption, one logic bug, and then one, I don't know, information leak via bit flipping and, you know, I don't know, voltage measuring. They're going to be similar enough that if I report, oh, I found a memory corruption that operates like this, when that gets public, people are going to look and they're going to find the same thing. They're going to find similar bugs because they know, oh,
yeah, so your hypothesis is based on or your thinking is based on the assumption that because you found them, they're related because you're using a particular technique or something.
Right. So, but if you were to say three independent people at my company or whatever, at my agency found three different bugs in Android, I think that that's extremely, I mean, it's possible, but implausible, given Android is a very, very hard target these days. So you will see that the, for example, Zerodium pays $2.5 million for Android and $2 million for iOS.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, that's not like an agency would pay differently than Zerodium. So, yeah, like Android is a hard target. One of the things is when you do find, you know, if you were to have those three bugs, I don't think you should bother reporting them. I wouldn't stockpile them, so to speak. But
I mean, what's the difference between not reporting them and stockpiling? Because, I mean, to me, it does seem plausible that if you happen to find multiple bugs on a target, you may not report them. And the concept of these organizations stockpiling is just stupid. But I can see that there could be examples where they would not reveal bugs and have multiple.
Yeah. So I agree. And I mean, if that's what they mean by stockpiling, I think that they misunderstand what's happening. The idea is not so much like we're going to have 10 O-days on the shelf. You may be in situations where for something that is highly relevant, like a Chrome browser exploit, you are always going to need Chrome exploits. So if you have two, you're not going to strip yourself down to just one, right? Because if one gets patched, you do need to have coverage for when that's out the window. Do you need...
Yeah. So the expectation is that they've got a short lifetime. I was just trying to think of NSO Group in particular. They had some exploit and it took them some number of months to tool up another one after it had gotten burnt, I think, by Citizen Lab. And I think it was a totally different one.
Well, that's sort of the other thing as well, is that if you find three bugs and they're sort of related, maybe in the same area, the same type of bug, something like that, the investment that you do to exploit the first one is going to be fairly high. But then the second two, you already have that base of knowledge. And so you can transfer, you know, the skills that you've developed, maybe the tooling or whatever, to the next one and the next one. So if you have to, if you have three completely different bugs, then the amount of upfront investment for each of them is the same because it's completely fresh each time. And these days, I mean, just iOS, you're looking at months. Like you've got a bug, it takes months to exploit it, then months to make it reliable. And then if you're going to operationalize it, that's probably another month. So you're looking at just a huge amount of work. And if, you know, let's put a pin in that and come back to it when we start talking about the last one that they have, because the other thing is this work is highly paid, extremely skilled professional labor, right? Like it's expensive work, even if they work for you as an agency, not that you purchase it externally. Like these are not your lowest level employees.
You know? No, that's right. You sort of look at the Google Project Zero does some fantastic write-ups of this kind of work. And it's kind of amazing. Well, it is amazing. It's amazing that they can explain it in a way that I kind of go, oh yeah, I kind of see what's going on here. And realize enough that there's no way I could ever do this.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So just to summarize this little part, we think stockpiling is stupid, but also there is a reason that you could line up a number of vulnerabilities because you know they're going to get lost. And I guess NSO is a good example of a capable organization where its exploits are getting discovered and patched regularly. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to happen. I don't really think of that as stockpiling.
No.
But anyway, let's move on to the last one, D.
So one thing that we should do on the stockpiling is the reason they don't want stockpiling is they believe that there's going to be exploit collisions and that if you are sitting on bugs, then they will be found elsewhere by bad actors who will then abuse them. And so I don't think that that's very realistic because except for sort of niche cases, generally speaking, there's not bug collisions, particularly some of the more high-end type of bugs that are being used by these agencies. So if we look at Eternal Blue, right? They had the Eternal Blue exploit for the better part of a decade. And even after it was patched, no one had any idea about it because it was just so extremely complicated in how it got to the point where it was an exploit. And then once the exploit itself was out, that was a problem. And I think one of the issues is if you look at this idea of like you have to give all your bugs up, in a way you're going from, in theory, someone could find this by accident and then exploit it, to we're going to make these bugs public and people will have access to them.
Right, yeah. So this really ties into the fourth recommendation, which is state authorities can keep vulnerabilities for a limited time to exploit them. So I don't like that part. It then says each member state should therefore have a vulnerability equity process. That is a process to decide, do we take advantage of this vulnerability we found or do we patch it? I actually agree with that part. I think that makes sense.
Yeah,
it's just the first part, the limited time. And you've already started to talk about it. It just doesn't make sense.
So I think there's a lot of reasons this doesn't make sense. One of them we just touched on, which is this sort of work is expensive work, right? So if you economically model two agencies, one of them doesn't keep a bug for more than 12 months, and one of them keeps it for its natural lifespan. And then you see like which one needs a budget that's three times the other one, right? And it's going to be the one that only has 12 months. It's not necessarily economically feasible if your budget is always going to replacing a perfectly working tool just because, you know, there's an expiration date that's not real. It's artificially added. So that's massively expensive. But then the other reason that I think that this is not smart is, so we know that patching doesn't happen, right? Like it should, and just, but it doesn't. Like, so there's the nice idea that you give it to the vendor creates a patch in a timely fashion, everyone installed the patch, and now that vulnerability is no longer a vulnerability. And I want to cry out about how that's not necessarily the case. Right, like WannaCry was patched for months and it still took down the NHS.
Yeah.
And that's because an exploit became public. Not the vulnerability, the exploit. But that was a particularly complex case. Generally speaking, almost all of the vulnerabilities that are used to gain access to companies are known patched bugs.
Yep.
Right. Look at what is ransomware using. It's like, oh, they're using CVE 2020 this or CVE 2017 that, you know, CVE 2019 some VPN thing. You know, it's not, oh, we discovered an O-Day being exploited in the wild by this criminal group. It's always, guys, if you've got a VPN appliance that you've had on the network for 3 years, please patch it at least once, you know, like.
Yeah. So CISA, the US cybersecurity organization, has quite a long list of known exploited vulnerabilities. Right. So if I could sum up this part then, what you're saying is that it, from the point of view of a state organization, it just makes no sense to throw out perfectly good things. That's the tools that work, capabilities that work. It just becomes very expensive. So that's the best case, right? Right. If you're living in a perfect world, you just cost yourself a whole lot of money. Right. But we don't live in a perfect world. So, in fact, what you're doing is the side effect of throwing away all those vulnerabilities is that they then get exploited publicly. So there's sort of a double whammy.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, I'd point out that year on year, it gets more complex to find bugs and exploit them. So you're not just throwing out a perfectly good tool and getting another one. You're buying a more expensive one.
Right, yeah. Right.
You, like, this one worked, cost us $1 million to develop. Let's get rid of it and get another one for $2 million. And then next year it's going to be $4 million or whatever. You know, like that's not sustainable. You know, if your budget stays the same and your tools have to be thrown out and then repurchased at a higher price, you're going to not be happy. But yeah, the number of bugs that are exploited that are O-Day used by bad actors is very, very small. Now, I guess the argument that they're going to make is like, yeah, it's small, but you know, it counts for the people who get targeted. And this is a thing about the government's purchasing this stuff, using it in a way that is, we can agree, is misuse or it's abuse, right? the problem is that there's not a technical solution to a political problem. Right? The problem is that these governments want to spy on the opposition. It's not because they have O-Day, right? Like the O-Day is not the problem here.
I mean, to me, all these things are very dual use. So you can use them for good purposes or bad purposes, depending upon your point of view. And these recommendations are all about just tamping down. Well, the ones we don't like are all about just tamping down on it, full stop. And I think it's very hard to tamp down on the whole ecosystem without squashing both the good and the bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the real part where it's counterproductive is the removing the brain drain, or how do you push brains away?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a brain drain.
Brain expulsion force. I think there's a number of externalities and second order effects that this creates, which are just inherently bad. It increases the number of unpatched known vulnerabilities. And I say unpatched just because we know people do not patch.
Yep.
Right. So where there's a patch available, but people don't install. Basically, the only thing where you're going to find, you know, well-patched software is going to be iOS. When you are worried about people using O-Day against people who have handsets, that's a threat for a subset. The majority of them are running things that do not need O-Day, that just need known vulnerabilities. And so, if your legislation creates more known vulnerabilities, you have not helped protect those people.
Yep. Yep.
It's just, I think it's a bad idea that would be poorly implemented and have no positive effects on what they're trying to change, lots of negative effects for them and for other people.
So, thanks a lot, Grok.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Talk to you later.